The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
This grew out of their question as to whether the evidence would support a regulatory measure that would restrict concentration of THC in various inhaled products.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians. This episode of Annals on Call features an article titled High Concentration Delta-9 Tetrahydrocannabinol, Cannabis Products, and Mental Health Outcomes, a Systematic Review. Joining us on the podcast are two of the authors, Dr. John Samet, who's a pulmonary physician and the previous dean of the Colorado School of Public Health, and Dr. Paula Riggs, who's a professor of psychiatry at Colorado. We hope you learn something about what's going on with THC with higher concentrations. Paula and John, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I read your study with great interest because I'm aware of people who have really gotten in trouble from using high concentration THC. And I wanted to know what the difference was between the high concentration THC that we see today and the THC that people were using back when I was in college, which was over 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. So perhaps we could start out by talking about the increase in THC concentration over the years and how legalization in states like yours has had an impact on that. So maybe you could just give me some background on that.
So I'll give a quick response, and I'm sure Paul will weigh in. But as you pointed out, today's marijuana flower is a much higher concentration THC than what was around 40 or 50 years ago in the quote, the 60s. Then concentration of THC was in the 3, 4, 5% range. It's gone up since, and now probably in the United States, average is about 20% THC in flower, so far more potent. The other comment I would make is that the marketplace now has concentrates, products made from taking the THC from the flower and putting it into vape pens or other sorts of products like shatter and others that people heat to breathe in a very high concentration of THC. And then there's edibles. So big change in the marketplace.
Yeah, I just chime in too on top of that. Some of the concentrates, the dabs, the wax, the shatter, those have kind of taken an increasing position in the marketplace and are very popular. And some of those, and butane hash oil and all of those kind of concentrated products can be in the range of upwards of 70, 80, even above 90% THC concentration. That's such a super physiologic dose that we hardly know what to make of it. Is it even in a whole different category than the old, 2 or 3% a joint that back in the 60s? Right. So these are very new and very, very different high concentration products.
You mentioned edibles, and certainly I know plenty of people who are using edibles and have gotten in trouble because the edible doesn't act as quickly, and so they took too much and then had a very bad evening. Do you know what the concentration is in the various edibles?
Well, the it's not the concentration, it's the total milligrams.
Okay.
That's important. And of course, one of the most famous accounts of eating an edible was Maureen Dowd's column about getting totally stoned out of her mind in Denver about right after legalization. So the challenge there, and I know Paula can weigh in on this, is that the dosing is variable, absorption is variable, takes time. So people may not know what's going to happen in an hour or two after they perhaps take another edible because they expected something more to happen. The amount of THC in the edibles is limited to different amounts, but it's the dosing and the variation among people that's so important, and the outcome and how much THC eventually peaks in the brain.
They say the serving size, though, is 10 milligrams per a serving size. Still, for someone naive to cannabis, that is going to kind of knock you out. But the onset's a half an hour in, you go, well, that wasn't so bad, and then take another one. That's the real risk of the edibles.
And I've seen that happen to somebody, and
Yes.
it was ugly. I was so pleased to read in your article that the Colorado legislature funded this study. I think that's totally appropriate. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about how that happened and how that allowed you to do the best you could with the data that are available.
Right, and I certainly agree that the Colorado legislature was farsighted in supporting the work that we did. This project grew out of their question as to whether the scientific evidence would support a regulatory measure that would restrict concentration of THC in various inhaled products. There was a group. Well motivated, the group included a pediatrician, and they asked and learned that, in fact, the literature was not adequate. Consequently, they moved ahead with this House Bill 1317, which passed in 2021, which called on the Colorado School of Public Health, and in fact, its dean, which I was at the time, to carry out a review of the evidence on their language high potency marijuana and concentrates. We did that carrying out a scoping review, surveying the broad landscape of the literature, and then for mental health, followed with this systematic review. There's an additional component to the project, which involves developing an educational campaign for the public, which has been in progress now for about a year plus.
So, how did you decide for the review what criteria you would use for including an article in the study?
So, two parts to the answer. First, we built off the scoping review, and the scoping review had eventually over 500 studies included, and they were studies that we thought, by our criteria, would provide information on higher concentration products. And we used a somewhat open definition. We said that such products would exceed 5 milligrams of THC or 10% THC, and then allow us to have a control or some comparison between higher and lower, or higher and nothing, or a placebo. The one challenge with the literature is that it lags what's in the marketplace. What's there, perhaps the studies on today's vape pens or other, the products that Paula mentioned will have some more work out in 5 years. But as you know, the cycle of research is slow, and there's a real lack of funding to do the needed research. So we, as a limitation, and this goes back to our attempt to be inclusive in selecting studies, still did not find as many as we would hope to have or we need to address current clinical questions about what's out there and what can be purchased.
And the analysis, as I read it, this seemed to be doing the best you could with mediocre data. Is that fair?
That is really fair. I mean, the state of the science out there, and I think that's one of the most important things about the study, is it shows how limited the current research, state of research is. And the good news is, hopefully, this review and the scoping review and the mental health consequences will be updated on an ongoing basis, because you're right, the even these results, trying to focus on high concentration products, does not reflect what's out there in the concentrations in the marketplace currently.
Great. Well, let's go through. You had five categories of study, and let's go through those one at a time and do the best we can to inform our listeners what they might expect. And I assume that there are, I live in a state that there's no legalization, but there's still plenty of people getting gummies and whatever from because it's available in so many other states. So let's go over anxiety first.
Okay. I can give you, I'll give a quick summary. And anxiety was one of the major categories where the literature was abundant. And we, in fact, found 68 studies that addressed anxiety. Now, I will say that, again, one problem with the literature, there's no sort of standard definition of anxiety that was used. So we followed what the author said they were studying. And with anxiety, as with the other outcomes we looked at, we provide the results in a number of different ways we hope will be helpful by the nature of the study population. And there, the real demarcation is between those that are labeled as, quote, healthy or not healthy, essentially having mental health condition or other conditions. We also looked at, and this applies to the other outcomes we'll talk about, whether the study was done to identify a benefit, and we called those therapeutic studies. And then there are additional comments. We classified the study by the risk of bias, the technical approach used in systematic review to identify the limitations of studies. I think it's just important to say that almost all studies were found to be at risk for bias, and only, I think, 4 or 5% were at the best level. So for anxiety, again, looking at the results for healthy populations, we found that 64% of the studies provide, let me back up. 64% of the associations evaluated in the studies showed unfavorable results for healthy populations. So one complication in interpreting the tables, and just want to make this clear, is some studies evaluated multiple outcomes. So that for anxiety, for example, we had 68 studies with 96 associations, different measures of anxiety. So there, for healthy populations, the balance of the evidence of the associations was towards unfavorable. For those people, again, the small number here, but with mental health issues, 36% were favorable, 36% unfavorable. So pretty balanced. Perhaps not surprisingly, of the studies that were intended to look for benefits, 47% of them found favorable results. That is a positive outcome from the point of view of reducing anxiety. 24% found the opposite, unfavorable associations. Again, there was a tendency towards benefit in the quote therapeutic study. So a mixed picture. I mean, I think the two things that would really stand out would be the high percentage of associations being unfavorable in healthy populations. That's the 64% figure I mentioned. And again, for studies undertaking to look at benefits, 47% of the associations being favorable.
Great. Paul, what about depression?
Well, I'll talk about depression and the anxiety as well, but
Yeah.
I think it's important that again we understand the limitations. The studies, the 99 studies included in this, only l less than fewer than half kind of met that gold standard design of randomized controlled trial. And even among the randomized controlled trials with a good control comparison group, the risk bias was very high. And that is, they didn't use a standardized measure for anxiety, for example, or they had other confounds. And then the other studies, the more than half, observational studies or pre-post change without a comparison group, again, low quality evidence. So I think we really have to understand that's just the state of the science right now in this area. So let me just comment, whether it's depression or anxiety. So mostly unfavorable outcomes in healthy populations using these high concentration. And I think the kind of the overall conclusion, the higher the potency, the higher the THC concentration, the greater the risk, certainly for psychosis and for developing a cannabis use disorder, and also for unfavorable outcomes in terms of anxiety and depression. Now, Jonathan mentioned, what about the therapeutic? The studies that had kind of were looking at, is there a therapeutic in a therapeutic population? It's important to look at the populations that were studied in that regard. That is, so only 10 of the studies were primarily looking at anxiety, mental health outcomes. Most of these patient populations where they're looking at a therapeutic benefit are like chronic pain patients, cancer patients with cancer, patients with neurologic disorders. And the confound there is we know that cannabis of any potency or high concentration or low has a direct effect on reducing pain and on reducing nausea. For example, that's known. So when you look at the effect of whether cannabis has a favorable, unfavorable outcome for anxiety in those populations, you got to wonder, well, if it reduces my nausea as a cancer patient, I'm going to be less anxious going in. It's going to make probably my depression as well. If it's going to reduce my pain directly, it's probably going to help my anxiety and my depression. That's the confound in these ther the therapeutic thing. And these confounds were largely not controlled for. And the same for the neurologic patients. So I think a grain of salt when we think about favorable outcomes. And I guess my overall comment would be when you the issue when you're just looking at that snapshot of high con studies that looked at in relatively high concent THC concentration cannabis products, you can't lose the larger context of literature of just cannabis research in general looking at anxiety at mental health outcomes. And overall, there's a several systematic reviews with rigorous criteria for including studies. Those studies pretty much show that are consistent with the APA guidelines, American Psychiatric Association guidelines, that there is no psychiatric disorder for which cannabis is a therapeutic, is an indicated treatment. And I think we have to come out with that. But so for depression, in some of the therapeutics, studies showing favorable outcomes for depression or anxiety, I think we certainly need more research, but I think you have to take it with it in the context of, well, if it was in cancer patients and in chronic pain patients, what were the confounds?
So, one of the things that I knew before I read this study, I think I knew, was the psychoses and schizophrenia were the biggest concern with cannabis. Is there any evidence that it's even worse with the high concentration than with the lower concentrations? Because I think we've known about that for quite some time.
Yes. And I think that did come out not only in the scoping review, but also in this sub study. And that is the higher the concentration of THC, the greater is the risk of either initial onset psychosis or exacerbating psychotic symptoms in those with a history of psychosis.
So I think that's a big take home. I
It
had
is.
never heard of cannabis use disorder. Give me like the 1 minute elevator speech on cannabis use disorder.
When you look at the diagnostic criteria that we use for any substance use disorder, there are 11 symptoms. There are 11 symptoms that we make this diagnosis. Does your use kind of unfair, have you used in situations that increase risk, like driving while intoxicated, et cetera? Has it interfered with your ability to work, for example, or kind of get things done in your life? Have you had experienced withdrawal symptoms or symptoms of tolerance, physiologic tolerance? Have you attempted to cut down unsuccessfully? You've tried to stop or reduce, but not. Have you gone situations where you use more than intended? There's 11 symptoms, and the same symptoms are true for whether you're diagnosing cannabis use disorder, methamphetamine, or opioid use disorder. And so cannabis use disorder has those same 11 criteria. So that's the definition. If you have two of those 11 symptoms, that's mild cannabis use disorder. If you end up with, three, four, five, that's moderate. And in six or above, that's severe cannabis use disorder. So that's the same criteria for any. And yes, so I think there was a clear indication that the use of any cannabis over a prolonged period of time increases your risk of developing a cannabis use disorder. And the higher concentration cannabis products have a greater addictive potential, if you will, or risk for developing a cannabis use disorder.
And the final one, does it have any impact on other substance abuse?
That's a very interesting, trickier question. This review, I think, only look had maybe
Just a
three,
handful of studies, Paula.
just a handful of studies that. However, there is a larger context of literature. And it matters at what developmental stage you're looking. There's evidence that when, most adults who suffer from chronic substance use disorders or common parlance addiction started using when they're adolescents. And there's certainly some evidence from animal studies and human studies that if you start using cannabis, that may kindle your brain in a way that increases your risk for really liking other substances tried later, or increasing your risk of developing other substance use disorders. I think that's pretty clear from the overall literature. In terms of the studies of high concentration, we've just got a handful of studies. We can't make much of it.
Great. So to put it all into a summary, as best we can tell, it's not doing people any big favors, the high concentration, and some people are suffering because of it, but our data are not very good. So where do you think we should be going in the future to better sort these issues out? And is the Colorado legislature, are you aware of any other states that are doing this? Because I know the federal government has not wanted to do these studies in the past. Perhaps that'll change.
Right.
But just both y'all's final thoughts on where this field should go.
Right. I think everybody thinks it needs to go in a better direction, for one, as a starter. We've actually taken some steps in that direction. So we've published two papers just really highlighting the deficiencies of the literature in a systematic way, one in the American Journal of Public Health and one in the American Journal of Epidemiology, sort of methodological in its focus. Paula was a participant in a workshop we held about a year ago, bringing together some of the country's leading cannabis researchers to talk about improving methods. And we have a workshop report that will be coming out to get at the issue you raised, Bob, this just deficiencies of the literature. We really do need a systematic research agenda and one that's funded.
Yes.
One that's not limited by the restrictions on what can be studied. The legally available THC products for NIH-funded research just don't match the marketplace. So we have a sort of an emerging public health problem, growing legalized recreational use, and we don't lack the evidence and even sort of the research resources to address the questions that are reasonably asked. So I think that's a problem that really needs to be taken on. Some states, I mean, I'll applaud Colorado here, Oregon, Washington State. Some others have taken steps. They've tried to look at the science. They've tried to identify research priorities. But to my knowledge, there's not really a strategic national agenda to address this challenge.
We are, for example, at University of Colorado, we have, I'm kind of the associate center director for, it's a federal National Institute on Drug Abuse funded center for cannabis research. And we are moving forward with cannabis research. In fact, looking at studies of people who are using in their natural environment. We can, again, it's we're really hamstrung by this issue. What we can't use products in the marketplace for randomized controlled trials. That's a real constraint on us. But nonetheless, the federal government and National Institute of Health, it's very interested in research. And so, we're still hamstrung in that regard, but we are moving forward on research. We need rigorous study, gold standard studies. We know how to do that. The control for the confounds, randomized controlled trials to see what are the health. And there may be some populations that we need to look at, cancer patients or chronic pain patients, where there may be some benefit, but we really need to have some of those constraints lifted so we can really look at these high concentration products that are available that people are using widely, but we ha don't have the research to help guide what are the risks.
Well, I can't thank y'all enough for publishing this study and for allowing our listeners to better understand where the science is, where the science isn't, and where we need to be going. So thanks very much for joining the podcast.
Thanks for
Great.
that.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you.
Absolutely.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. The first big message from this discussion was how much higher the concentration of THC is today than back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. This higher concentration carries with it certain risks. Unfortunately, most of our studies are fairly inadequate in general because we can't do randomized controlled trials. And collecting data is problematic. But we can say from this article that there's no evidence that THC helps mental health. And we do have enough evidence to say that the biggest risk of higher concentration THC is a higher risk of psychosis and schizophrenia. It's certainly possible that THC helps some patients with chronic pain, a severe nausea with chemotherapy, and we need more studies. We also very much would benefit if the NIH would allow studies with these higher concentrations so that we can provide better information for patients and for their physicians. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall